House Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Today is Friday, January 27th, and let the record reflect that it is 1 o'clock, 1:00 p.m., and I intend to start this committee promptly every day that we meet on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays here in the Groomberg Committee Room. Today we have present Vice Chair Representative Allard next to me. We have Representative Craig Johnson, we have Representative Eastman, Representative Groh, and Representative Gray, and myself, Chair Vance. This is a friendly reminder to please turn off your cell phones. The staff assisting us today are Sophia Tenney with House Records and Talia Ames with the Juneau LAO. Thank you for your work. So I just want to welcome you to House Judiciary Committee. I trust that each of you received your welcome letter. I just want to go over a few housekeeping things. We are going to specifically address matters of law and justice, obviously, but we carry some of the weightier matters that come through with law. And I provided that letter as a brief overview of some of the things that we will be considering. My policy on amendments and committee bills are also listed on that welcome letter that I'd like you to make note of. You have been provided a courtesy binder, and in the future, we will be emailing you the documents so that you can choose to create a binder for yourself or have them on digital content. That's what I prefer. Saves a lot of paper in the building. So amendments to all bills must be emailed to my office no later than the specified day and time as noticed in committee. So at the point that we are ready to take up amendments on any legislation, I will provide a notice in committee that day, and that will be included in a courtesy email as a reminder to give you time to make those preparations. We will not be taking, you don't have to worry about any of that for today, so you can kind of relax a little bit, but I'm just letting you know what my policy is, and it is written. Because judiciary is a matter, pertains to matters of justice, I want us to take a moment and reflect on the sheer responsibility of justice. And I would like to reflect for the record at 1:02 p.m. that Representative Carpenter has joined us. I ask myself several questions when it comes to matters of justice. And I ask myself, what do I believe in? And I think that I'm bringing this up today as we begin this journey in the committee, as some of the weightier policies come before us that will impact the entire state. And I ask myself the question, is it liberty or social justice? Does it affirm the rule of law or the rule of man? Capitalism versus socialism. Individual rights versus collective rights. Does it preserve life or terminate it? These are the questions that I ask myself and I use as a measure before I consider any piece of legislation, especially those that we consider in this committee. And so I ask you to look to the great law books for these weighty decisions. And I've included a piece from one of the great law books in Leviticus 19:15 on the welcome letter that says, "Do not pervert justice. Do not show partiality to the poor or favoritism to the great, but judge your neighbor fairly." And that is what we are committed to do in this committee room, and in every piece of legislation that we move. So I would, I welcome you to this committee. I look forward to working with each one of you, but we do have two items on today's agenda I'm very excited about. So our first, the committee will take up HB 38 appropriation limit in its first hearing, and then we'll set the bill aside. And second, the committee will take up HB 11, crime and assault in the presence of a child, in its first hearing and set the bill aside. So I will take a brief at ease to be able to get the presentation set up for House Bill 38. To give us his presentation on House Bill 38 appropriation limit. And any other staff that you may have with you are welcome to the table.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to the wonderful members of the House Judiciary Committee, with the permission of the chair, I would like to welcome as a co-presenter today a friend from the other body, Senator James Kaufman.
Please welcome Senator James Kaufman, a previous member of this body. Please state your names for the record and begin your bill presentation.
Thank you. State Senator James Kaufman, District F, Anchorage.
State of Alaska, House Representative from District 32, Will Stapp.
Please continue.
Thank you. Madam Chair, just a quick housekeeping note for yourself and the members of the committee through the chair. Both Senator and myself have a hard deadline of 1:20 in which our staff members will be replacing us to continue all the questions and any further presentations for the committee. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, without further ado, now that we've been introductions, so today we're going to discuss HB 38 on the House side. Of course, a member of the other body has another similar bill, actually a companion bill on the Senate side, referencing an act entitled to a GDP-based spending cap or a revised appropriation limit through the state of Alaska. And I would like to refer the members of the committee through the chair to the resolution statement, or rather the sponsor statement for HB 38. I will not read it in its entirety, but I say I'll hit the highlights, so to speak. And how do I move the slides? That's a good question. I think I can figure this out. Hold on. I'm gonna hit the slide too.
I think the arrows button might help you.
Brief at ease, Madam Chair.
Brief at ease. Back on record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to the members of the committee. This is an overview of the bill. So for starters, we're going to talk about the structure of the appropriation limit with our exemptions list. All appropriations will be subject to the limit that's defined by the calculation factor, a starting point, a growth rate, other types of mechanisms that limit appropriations. In accordance with the current appropriation limit. So most of you probably know that the state of Alaska already has a constitutional appropriation limit. And part of the nucleus behind the conception of this idea was the existing appropriation limit is so astronomical that there's effectively not a limit at all because we couldn't possibly spend the amount of revenue available to hit the existing cap. So basically what we are proposing is a twofold. There is a bill to create a new statutory limit that will work in hand in hand with an unnamed constitutional limit. So effectively, as I continue on through the slides, Constitution Article 9, Section 16, which was effective in 1982, this is kind of the nucleus behind that, was the existing spending cap. And it says appropriations from the Treasury made for fiscal year shall not exceed $2.5 billion by more than the cumulative change derived from federal indices and prescribed by law in population and inflation. So in layman's speak, basically the existing appropriation limit that we have is indexed to inflation and population growth, which is kind of the reason why it has not been the best type of metric in the state of Alaska's history, because conceptually it was designed to mitigate boom and bust cycles in revenue and spending, and because the metric of population growth and inflation ended up not being able to keep a lid on those types of appropriations. And if you would, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn over the continuation of the presentation to Senator Kaufman.
Not the continuation, just a little bit.
Yeah. Right. Here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Senator James Kaufman. And I just want to say first that it's great to be back over here in this room. We've done a lot of work with some of the members here when I was a member of the previous body. And it's great, Madam Chair, to see you in that seat. So I appreciate you hearing this legislation. This was created out of an effort to create a more beneficial process control around our budgeting. As was noted by Representative Stapp, our current limit is it's there, but it's the perfect law in that it can never be broken. So what we started looking at as we were looking deeply at fiscal policy in the previous legislature was how can we create mechanisms that can provide beneficial control while perhaps enhancing other aspects of our state. And with the case of this bill and its companion resolution, which is not before us right now, that what the idea was to reference our private sector economic activity, determine a beneficial percentage of that would represent responsible spending. And so the bill as you're looking at it today is based around that. How can we reference our economy? And the state GDP minus government spending is the most holistic expression of that we could find. We referenced that. We created a factor in the bill, 11.5%, with the idea being that that's the healthy percentage. It was pinned at what we did in 22 of the items that are under the cap. It referenced right at what we did in 22. So that's how the number currently stands. Now, the constitutional resolution has a higher limit, and the two work together in order to create the high limit and then kind of the operating limit that's expressed in the bill. So that's how we designed it. It has a five-year trailing average, and the benefit of that creates a very nice smoothing effect. As you've seen, perhaps the handouts that show the graph, the yellow or gold bars are the spending that's affected by the cap, and the lower line is the statutory limit, and the middle line is the new constitutional limit. Again, that's in the resolution, not before this committee right now. And then the high one that's flying way up there in the air, not doing very much, is actually our current constitutional limit. And so that's the mechanism. So the idea is measure what matters, measure our economy, and determine beneficial spending ratios off of our economic activity, and then use that to determine what we in the legislature do. Average it over 5 years so that there's no harsh movements or abrupt transitions. That creates a nice smoothing factor, because one thing that challenges Alaska is our boom and bust economic cycle. And when we get synchronized boom and bust, it's not a good thing, and it's something that has plagued us. What's in and what's out, as I refer to it, so what's under the cap, what's not, is a very typical list of things that are included and aren't included. We don't try to limit emergency spending in case of an emergency. You wouldn't want to do that. The permanent fund dividend is not under the cap. That's going to be a separate solution as part of our fiscal policy plans that we're all working on. Fund transfers. So if you're moving money around from account to account in the state, that's not counted as spending. That's just moving money. So the what's in, what's out, the mechanism, I think I've kind of gone over that, and trying to think if there's anything else that I need to hit. So you'd like it back?
Absolutely. So,
all right. Thank you. Well, at this point, I'll hand back, and I'll be able to be here for about another 6 minutes or so for questions, should there be any for me.
Thank you, Senator Kaufman.
Pardon me as I navigate the strategy of the microphone moving. So just to clarify on what the senator said, Madam Chair, through the chair to the members of the committee, what is limited by this proposal and what is not limited by this proposal. So just kind of listing them out, what is limited by this proposal is all UGF operating expenses, all UGF capital expenses, some designated general fund items, and most statewide items. But probably what is more important is what is not going to be limited by the cap, as the senator mentioned: permanent fund dividends, appropriations to the permanent fund, i.e. things like that, as well as power cost equalization, appropriations to savings account, i.e. money that is put in the CBR, direct spending on disaster declarations. This common example would be the big storm that we had in Western Alaska not too long ago. Federal money appropriations, and of course, proceeds of bonds. And a reminder to the committee as well, this would be an excellent time if you had questions for us, because we have, I think, about 5 minutes left. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Stapp. And I will open up for questions at this time. It is my intent to have this bill back before this committee, so know that you don't have to get in all your questions today. We will have another bite at the apple, but I will open it up with Representative Eastman.
So just in a high-level question, so will this bill be functional without a constitutional amendment? I mean, obviously, we do have a current statutory limit, which we habitually ignore. Would you expect that this would be treated differently without the constitutional amendment?
Can we brief at ease, Madam Chair?
With its companion resolution, again, it sets the high limit, the resolution does. While the bill sets, as I said, I call it the operating limit, the lower limit, and then the interplay between them is determined. So, no, this bill, as currently written, requires its companion resolution, but it's that resolution is not before this committee right now.
Thank you,
Representative Gray.
Hi, thank you so much for both being here. And my question has to do with what Senator Kaufman just said. So I understand the constitutional limit would be at 14%, and the statutory limit would be at 11.5%. And so really, it's like we're aiming for 11.5%, but if we hit 13%, we're fine. So it's kind of like we can ignore the 11.5% is how I'm kind of interpreting it, but that the constitutional limit would actually be the true hard limit. Is that a misperception?
Thank you, Representative Gray. Through the chair to Representative Gray. So we do have a member of Legislative Legal who is standing by to kind of alleviate some of the legal language in order to facilitate the move between the statutory and the constitutional limit. But again, the goal, as Senator Kaufman referenced, is the two types of pieces of ideas here do go work hand in hand, if that makes sense and answers your question.
Thank you. If I may just add, you have it's not just you can ignore it, but you have to have a two-thirds vote to exceed it. And the idea is that is for capital spending as constructed. And then the purpose for that is to get into a healthier bandwidth of capital spending as opposed to OPEX. So as we have these booms and busts, we start to lose the ability to maintain capital spending with, you know, deferred maintenance, everything. We get a lot of money, we spend like crazy, and then we can't afford, I call, you know, that the lottery syndrome. You build more house than you can maintain. So the idea of trying to moderate our spending and also create a more a layer of reliable capital spending is all of that workforce development, workforce retention, the ability to maintain our infrastructure, of just getting a healthier blend between operating expense and capital expense. And that's controlled by that two-third vote. Thank you.
Follow-up, Representative Gray?
I was just going to say, Madam Chair, that I have several questions today, so I'm happy to just be put back in the queue, and I'll just go when it's my turn. But I do have another question if you...
Now is the time.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So I'm curious about what percentage of the budget the PFD was last year, and part of that is, as I know, it's a significant portion. Why are we excluding the PFD from a spending cap?
It, really, to avoid just encroachment into too many areas. Through the chair. Sorry. To Representative Gray, that's an issue that really demands its own solution, both economically and politically. And so the cap is simply to be the foundation upon which we can begin to solve various issues. And so if you think of the slate of economic policy that was in the fiscal policy working group's report and other areas, other things that we can do, the idea is that a beneficial spending cap, I say beneficial because it references the private sector economy in order to help build that economy. And it provides capital spending in order to help build the capability for that economy. So you take all of that together. The idea is let's get this right. And then the other policy matters that we have to deal with, I believe they'll become much easier because you will have, you know, sideboards or a solid foundation that we can work with. Thank you.
Good for now. All right, Representative Groh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you to both Representative Staff and Representative Insider Coffin for bringing this forward. I have a number of questions about both the technical aspects of this legislation and the companion constitutional amendment, and also at the decision to bring forward a spending limit, which I ran on and support, a spending limit, the right one. But as the Fiscal Policy Working Group, which Senator Coffin just referenced and has been referenced repeatedly since the session started, said there needed to be a comprehensive and simultaneous solution to a lasting structural deficit. So as I said, I have a number of questions both about technical aspects and also about how this statutory and constitutional proposal would fit in to that overall approach, a comprehensive and simultaneous approach to resolving our structural deficit. So I'll proceed whichever way works best for you, Madam Chair.
Well, I appreciate that. We do want to be respectful of their time that they did state. It's now 1:21, and they are going to come back at another time. I encourage you to have more conversation, but we will take a brief at ease to do a swap. They have staff, illustrious staff who's been working on this issue as well. Senator Coffman.
Thank you, through the chair. To the chair as well. I just wanted to say that I'm in the building. Kind of a joke about my office is we never close. So feel free to drop by, and if you want to have any further private, conversations on this, but also we have very capable staff that are here. If you want to, go through a few more questions, they're more than capable to address perhaps some more detailed questions.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the Judiciary Committee.
Record, and we can begin fielding questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the Chair and to the members of the committee, Bernard Otto, staff for Representative Staff.
For the record, Matthew Harvey, staff to Senator Coffman.
And do we have any further questions on House Bill 38? Representative Gray.
Hi, thank you. Would the governor's fiscal year 24 budget fall underneath the spending cap?
Through the chair to Representative Gray, from our understanding, the current proposed budget wouldn't fall under this cap. However, our understanding is this is just a proposal at this time, and therefore the governor or any, even the legislature, has no obligation to follow a simple proposal.
Follow up?
So my understanding would be if we did have the spending cap, then we would be asking the governor to cut his budget. Is that the correct understanding?
Through the chair to Representative Gray, if the spending cap is as it is proposed currently, is enacted through the legislature, then the governor would have to follow it as an act of statute.
Follow up?
I'll wait. I have one more, but I'll wait.
All right. Representative Groh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll understand completely if the answer is ask my boss, but I do have a fundamental question here, as I suggested. Why are we proceeding with proposals for a spending limit statute and another in the Constitution, given that the Fiscal Policy Working Group recommended a simultaneous and comprehensive solution and said that was an essential element of the approach?
Thank you. For the record, Matthew Harvey, staff to Senator Coffman, through the chair to Representative Groh. This is the proposal that's in front of the body currently. I'm also not very familiar with all the other bill proposals that are in front of the House, but if the House wants to take up other proposals, I think that it's the will of the committee chairs to do so, and this is the proposal that's currently in front of the body.
Thank you. I have yes, I appreciated the graphic presentation, which included a graphic that showed spending, including real per capita spending. I took the liberty of arranging to have this that updated, because that year, I think, ended FY19, did not go to the present year. I arranged to have that graphic updated and split out by category. Madam Chair, I'll handle this wherever way you want. I have copies for everybody, if that's helpful.
Oh, but, we can have my staff distribute those?
Sure, but I can describe it or hand it out. What makes the most sense?
It makes sense to speak to it now.
Okay, so I'll arrange. I got copies for the whole committee here if the staff wants to get it. But I guess my point is this graphic shows, and it goes, and it's real per capita spending, like was shown in the presentation that was shown earlier. And it shows it from starts in fiscal year 1975, a couple years roughly before the construction of the pipeline, before the completion of the pipeline, and they've all started to flow through the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System. And it runs to the current year, fiscal year 2023, and it breaks it down by area. If you've seen, I guess you've got a copy now in front of you. Okay. If you could hand that, Mr.
Representative Groh, do you have a question for
me? I do. I guess my point is, I have two questions about this graphic. Number one is, do you notice that we're not at a peak in spending now, and we've had multiple peaks of spending in previous years?
Thank you. For the record, Matthew Harvey, staff to Senator Kaufman, and through the chair to Representative Groh, we also have more slides in this presentation that might touch on real versus nominal spending growth. And I'm sorry, but I haven't looked at this yet.
Okay. All right. I'm just going to point out and ask you a comment on that we're not at this peak in spending. We've had multiple peaks of spending a number of years. It was spending even above what we had this year, which is well above what we had in the past 5 or 6 years. Additionally, I would note, with all the focus on the operating budget, that the blue bars at the bottom, always the largest area of spending, is the per capita, real per capita agency operations, things like payments for the salaries of teachers, state social workers, state troopers, road maintenance, and road workers, that has not grown. That is only slightly higher than it was last year and is well below. And what really tends to vary a lot in our state, spending on permanent fund dividends, spending on the capital budget, it varies a lot, very substantially, and spending on what's called real per capita statewide operations, things like the interest on debt.
Representative Groh, do you have a question?
I wanted you to comment on, because we heard some comment about, hey, we need to protect the capital budget. Does it look like spending is, based on this graphic, that spending is the biggest issue in our state, number one? And number two, does it look like spending on agency operations is the biggest problem in our state?
Yes, Representative Carpenter.
This document does not have a seal or an indication that it's from Ledge Finance, so I'm not sure where the data and the background is. Before we get down the road, can you?
Sure, I completely went through the chair, like very much the answer. Representative Carpenter, I wanted to update this before, and so I even arranged to have this work done before I arrived and could get staff. I showed it to Alexi Painter, and he agreed with it based on the numbers, and so he analyzed it. But I wanted to show this. It's an updating of something that I had done back in 2020, and then I had it updated even before I came to this session. So
Representative Groh, for the body in the future, this is our first committee. I think it's our first committee in the House besides Finance, and I'm going to allow some leniency for today, but in the future, if you have something to share, please arrange it with my staff ahead of time.
Absolutely.
And any documents that we have, we need to make sure that we cite our sources that we can trust but verify. And also, we are going to be beginning our budget subcommittee soon, where Ledge Finance will have the fuller view of things. But I think now would be an appropriate time to let our great staffers finish their presentation so that we can have a better understanding of exactly what HB 38 covers, and then we will move on to the next bill. So please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the chair and through the chair to the body, we're going to be continuing on with the slideshow. And just to cover the how this is going to work, Matthew Harvey will be covering some of the mechanical aspects of the presentation, whereas I will be covering some of the policy-driven aspects of it.
Would you please state your name?
And I apologize, Bernardo Odo Staff for Representative Staff.
Thank you. And just for the listening pleasure of everyone, that is because we have a lot of male voices in the room, similar that it helps for the record. So I appreciate that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Matthew Harvey, staff to Senator Kaufman, for the record. And as Bernard said, I'll just continue through some of these slides very quickly. The current constitutional limit, the highlights are a little bit hard to see up on the screen, but there's a few various exemptions that aren't included in the limit, various fund sources as well as for purposes. The current limit applies to all unrestricted general fund spending, most statewide items, which a lot of that is retirement payments, and some DGF items, and a lot of those are just any DGF items that aren't directed constitutionally. It excludes PFDs. I believe we touched on that a little bit earlier. Bond proceeds, specifically general obligation bonds and revenue bonds, take up the largest portion of that. And one of the big reasons for that is that general obligation bonds are ratified by the voters. So if the voters can ratify it, then I don't believe that we should limit that. Debt service payments, non-state sources of revenue, which is the largest probably because of federal receipts that the state receives, public corporation revenues, and disaster declarations. We don't want to hinder the ability of the state to respond to an emergency. In addition to the current constitutional limit, we have a current statutory limit. It was enacted in 1986. A key here is it's based on appropriations made in a fiscal year, not for a fiscal year. One of the keys there, a large one, really the main thing there is supplementals, RPLs. Those account supplementals in the year appropriated, not in the year in which they're effective. And that's one thing that the mechanics of this bill change. Limit spending growth to population plus inflation plus 5%. And this is a major key as well. The use of both factors to calculate the limits caused the limit to outgrow its effectiveness. The timing of the data for the calculation of this limit doesn't work very well with the budget process. The limit's not known before the annual budget process, so they have an estimation of what the limit would be, and they're budgeting to an estimation because the data comes out next December, and they don't have that for the creation of the budget. Here's a graph of UGF spending history with a few key milestones: when North Slope oil starts flowing, when the constitutional spending limit passed, directly after a large increase in UGF spending. And then we have peak oil production noted on here and a bunch of years of flat spending after that. And then oil prices started to rise when production was still flowing. And you can kind of see some of those key milestones on this chart. And then here's another chart, and just a line chart that shows inflation and population-adjusted UGF spending. One key milestone on there is when the constitutional spending limit passed, right at the peak of this chart. So the proposed appropriation limit is calculated by subtracting government spending, state government spending, state contribution to GDP from historical state GDP values and adjusting for inflation. Sorry, I said that wrong. It is subtracting government spending from historical state GDP values and adjusting for inflation. Stability is an important thing, I believe, and stability is improved by averaging these values over the previous full five fiscal years in the current proposal. And then I believe we start to get a little bit into the policy decision, so I'll hand off to Bernard.
The constitutional amendment that is not in front of this body currently, but is essential to this bill, proposes a 14% cap of calculated value and the statutory limit as before this body. And my apologies before I continue. For the record, Bernardo Odo, staff to Representative Staff. The statutory limit as drafted in this proposal caps appropriations at 11.5%. For clarity, fiscal year 22 appropriations were roughly about $16 million below the current proposed cap, as represented by the graph on the next slide. So the next slide goes over the red line, as stated on there, is a current constitutional spending cap that was enacted in 1983. The black line is the constitutional proposal of 14%, and the blue line is the statutory cap of 11.5%. And as you can see, this is a reference to it if it were, if these were enacted back in fiscal year of 03, I think, go down a little bit more, and how these caps, if enacted at that time, would have capped the spending in those fiscal years. I will note that on this graph, what's represented is what's currently covered under the cap. So things like the permanent fund dividend and others that we've already highlighted that are not part of the cap are not reflected in these bars. The next slide, as was stated earlier, where exactly what is covered and what's in and what's not in the spending cap. So under this proposal, all UGF operating expenditures, all UGF capital expenditures, except those that are exceptions, such as appropriations that are federally mandated, so federal matches are not covered under if it's a capital expenditure. And retirement payments are not covered, are covered under this limit. Not limited are permanent fund dividends, appropriations to permanent fund, and the PCE endowment, appropriations to state savings such as the CBR and SBR, appropriations to capitalize state retirement accounts, direct spending on disaster declarations, and proceeds off of bonds approved by the voters. The expected effects and the benefits of this proposal is that we believe that they're effective and reasonable. It sets a cap roughly that's set at current levels that don't go above it, but also sets generous flexibility in the constitutional proposal if there's such if there needs to be such a need, in which case 2/3 of the body would be needed to go above that statutory limit. It's stable and predictable using that 5-year trailing average of GDP, and it provides a focus specifically on the private sector and encourages the state to focus on the growth of the private sector as opposed to other proposals previously before the body before.
Bernard, if we could pause for a moment, we have a question from Representative Allard.
Okay. Thank you. So, I'm hot mic. Okay. My question is, if I looked on here, you said it was proposed proceeds of bonds approved by voters. So are we, is there a reason you don't want this statute actually proposed and voted on by voters as well with the 11.5%? Am I incorrect?
For the record, Matthew Harvey, staff to Senator Kaufman, and through the chair to Vice Chair Allard, the proceeds of, for example, a general obligation bond, which is ratified by the voters, that amount won't be subject to the limit. The statute, because it's statutory, would not be that's simple majority vote. Constitutional resolution required a 2/3 vote to get through the both bodies in the House and the Senate, and then it goes to the people to be voted on and ratified for a constitutional amendment. Within that constitutional amendment is the mechanics of what's exempt from the cap and what's subject to the cap. So exempt from the cap would be proceeds from, for example, general obligation bonds. And those we would like to be exempt from the cap because they're going to be ratified by the voters. So we don't want them subject to the cap and limited if the voters are going to be approving that, if that makes sense.
Follow-up, Representative Allen?
I'm thinking. I'm good. Okay, thank you.
All right, please proceed with your presentation.
I think that was the last slide. For the record, Bernardo Otto, staff to representative staff, that is our last slide, and so we're now completely open to questions.
Any further questions by the committee? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for clarification, do we have any kind of time frame when this will be brought back up? Have you even given it a concern? Because I want to know how much I need to prepare, how quickly will determine the kind of questions I ask now. So
it is my intent that in this next week. We'll be doing receiving overviews from the Alaska court system on Monday and others before we bring this bill back before the committee, so you do have time.
Okay, good. Madam Chair?
Follow-up?
Please. Couple of things I'm going to want to know, I don't want to know today, is how the GDP is figured and how trailing it is to reality, just so that we can look into it. The other thing I'm going to want to know is if the state lets a contract for a road to a private individual, the letting of the contract is under the cap, but the money spent by the contractor, is that figured into GDP? And are we kind of double dipping and increasing our GDP with state money? So kind of artificially bumping the GDP with state money, and is that figured into it? So I don't know that there is an answer to that yet, but those are going to be questions that I'm going to want to kind of look at, is where those things are figured and how they are. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further questions by the committee? Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I second Representative Johnson's questions. I have a two-part question. The first is, do you have any examples of other states that have a spending cap based off the GDP?
Thank you. For the record, Matthew Harvey, staff to Senator Kaufman, and through the chair to Representative Gray, to seconding Craig Johnson's questions, I believe we have Rob Carpenter from Legislative Finance in the audience to answer the data source questions. With regards to the double dipping, we might have to get back to you in writing on that. And with regards to other states that have enacted a spending cap based on GDP, other states have enacted spending caps based on economic indicators, based on their productive economy. The GDP went through, the Bureau of Economic Analysis went through a little bit of a renewal process as to how they calculate GDP, and the numbers, the data quality improved a lot over the last 10 to 15 years. And there haven't been any states who have adopted that since that data quality improved, is my understanding. But there are states that have had success with economic indicator-based spending caps.
Thank you. So we would be the first to directly tie it to the GDP.
Through the chair to Representative Gray, yes, is my understanding.
My quick follow-up, if I may, is that my concern, and it's not something for you to answer now, but my concern would be that if the state were in a recession and our GDP were to fall low and the state might feel that we need to increase spending in order to stimulate the economy, that this spending cap would actually tie our hands in such a way that we couldn't increase spending. In fact, we would have to cut spending dramatically, which my fear would be with that could worsen a recession. So that's sort of my philosophical concern about a spending cap that's directly tied to the GDP. And I mean, I don't know if you have anything to add to that or if you can allay my concerns in any way, but that would be my concern.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. For the record, Matthew Harvey, staff to Senator Kaufman. And through the chair to Representative Gray, one of the benefits of having the five-year trailing average is that it actually will, if Alaska's GDP takes a massive hit in 1 year, it won't immediately see a massive hit to the spending cap. And there's pros and cons to that, I believe. But one of the pros of that is, say you have a two-family or a household in which somebody works in the private sector, somebody works in the public sector. And the private sector would see an immediate crash in GDP. And the public sector, with this appropriation limit in place, it would start to come down, but it wouldn't be a sharp slash immediately, and so you wouldn't have immediate dual layoffs, as an example. And it's one of the benefits is it starts to kind of lead just a little bit or lag just a little bit in that way. And it goes the other way too. If you see immediate spikes in GDP, then government spending would actually trail private sector growth for as long as it needs to. So it kind of has that benefit, that lag effect benefit on both sides, in my opinion.
Thank you. Representative Groh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Although the constitutional amendment is not before us, you referenced it, there are two lists of exceptions, one that's in this House Bill 38 for us, and another in SDR 2. can you explain the differences in the list of exceptions? There's 10, I count, in House Bill 38, and sort of 7 plus 1 in SDR 2.
For the record, Matthew Harvey, staff to Senator Kaufman, and through the chair to Representative Groh, I'm not sure I'm allowed to reference the resolution since it wasn't publicly noticed and in front of the body. I'm sorry.
Please speak to the bill at hand. I'm not sure the direction on when and if that amendment will come, and we can address it at that time. But if you could speak to what is in the bill.
Yes. So in the bill in front of the body, HB 38, for the record, Matthew Harvey, staff to Senator Kaufman, and through the chair to Representative Groh, we are making a few changes to the exceptions list that is currently in statute in AS 37.05.540B. We're adding appropriation of geobond proceeds to that exceptions list, adding payment of principal and interest on revenue bonds to the exceptions list, adding appropriations to a state account or fund that requires a subsequent appropriation from that account to a fund as prescribed by law, which includes appropriations to the CBR, appropriations to capitalize the permanent fund, appropriations to capitalize retirement funds, and so on and so forth. And we're also adding appropriations to meet a state of disaster declared by the governor as prescribed by law in disaster declaration law. I can go more in depth into the exceptions list, but those are the changes that we're making to the current statute.
I think that's appropriate at this time. Follow up, Representative.
Sure. Madam Chair, I note that the constitutional amendment proposal SDR 2 has not been referred to this committee. I would like that. I think that would be appropriate. And I would also I note that I share the concerns about the countercyclical effects that Representative Gray touched on. And I had a series of additional questions about that that might wait further development when the bill comes back before the committee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you. We will have this bill before us again. It is my intent to hear it again, but I am going to set HB 38 aside and take a public testimony at a later date on this piece, so you will have time to formulate more questions and chew on this a little bit more. I want to thank the staff for both Senator Kaufman and Representative Stapp for your presentation and work that you've done on this. And we will take a brief at ease to transition on the next bill. HB 11, Crime, Assault in the Presence of a Child, by Representative Andy Josephson. If he would like to join us. Please state your name for the record and begin.
Sure. Good afternoon. My name is Andy Josephson. I am a representative from Anchorage District 13. With me is my staff, Annalisa Roberts. We thank you for calendaring this bill. The committee, the bill in question first sort of came to my attention as an issue in around 1999-2000. At that time, I was a state prosecutor, and in 1999 began handling cases in Anchorage District Court, and mostly Anchorage District Court. Typically, the junior prosecutors would handle misdemeanors that had been reduced from felonies or standalone misdemeanors that had state crimes. But occasionally, I would come across the existence of a municipal ordinance, and it is a crime there called family violence. And I want to make sure that it's understood that this bill doesn't necessarily concern family violence. It's shorthand for the thing we're trying to proscribe, which I think is a fancy word meaning regulate or prohibit. We call it an act establishing the crime of assault in the presence of a child. The bill does not require that the child be familial to the assailants or combative parties. So that's one way in which it's different. But it's modeled off of a municipal code for sure. Now, so I first learned about this crime when I was a state prosecutor, and I could tell that we didn't have this in our statutes, and I thought it was an anomaly in that respect, and of course it was. In 2016, with SB 91, there was a limit placed on sentencing in municipal criminal codes. Essentially, comparable crimes in the state level could not, the municipal offense could not exceed the state offense, because the basic principle of SB 91 was to, in part, to focus on rehabilitation and restoration and reduce the corrections budget. So it made sense that that bill didn't want municipality to extend sentences beyond what the state would do in a comparable way. But again, we don't have a comparable crime like this. And then the knowledge of this crime came back to me in the form of my campaign, where a number of us got a questionnaire from the Alaska Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Association, ANDVSA, I think it is. And they asked, what are you going to do if elected to work on the problem of family violence, essentially? And I don't have my answer in front of me, but undoubtedly I said I would consider filing a bill just like this one. So this was the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault asking all of us, and presumably we all got the same thing. Specifically, they asked, children are a particularly vulnerable population, may be traumatized by living with an abusive person and witnessing violence perpetrated against a parent or caretaker. What remedies might you suggest to provide protection for these children? This is my remedy. Now, I will tell you that we know that we can have all sorts of criminal laws and still have criminality. But we also know, because it's sort of logical, that if we just deleted our entire code, criminality would rise. So this is not going to fix the problem of domestic violence in Alaska. But it's meant to send, if you will, a serious public service announcement that if you're going to engage in domestic violence, which is already a crime, that kids experience a separate trauma when they witness it. And that's the essence of the bill. I will comment on just a few more things about it. The first is that right now, in a sense, this isn't a great reach, because in the felony sentencing code, which is 1255-155, there is an aggravator, and the aggravator is somewhat different than this. So I didn't invent this out of whole cloth. We have something sort of similar, but I'll explain why this is also different. The aggravator is different in that it directs the attention of the juror, because the jurors typically have to prove up or find proof beyond a reasonable doubt of an aggravator, that the offense occurred either in that the offense was domestic violence. We don't require that in this crime, as I said. That the offense occurred in the home of the perpetrator, we don't require that. Or in the home of the victim, we don't require that either. So ours is a broader category in that sense. And to avoid duplication, a prosecutor would be required to select. So a prosecutor, for example, could find that he or she could pick their penalty. If, for example, the underlying offense was a misdemeanor, so two men are watching a football game in front of their children, they begin to get combative and they fight one another. And it's more than just, you know, incidental. Someone's eye is blackened. That could be an assault four. That would almost surely be a misdemeanor. So you're not in a felony world, and this other aggravator isn't affected one way or the other. It just doesn't come into play, right? In the instance I've described, if children were in the room watching football with these two gentlemen, for example, there could be a second offense charge of a crime of assault in the presence of a child. And we've defined what we mean by presence. We think we've done that well. You'll see the word in the bill, location. That word is used throughout the criminal code now. You'll see the word in the bill, dwelling. That is also defined currently in the criminal code. So we think that, you know, what you can't have in criminal law is ambiguity. And we think that we have dealt with that issue pretty well. The other thing that a prosecutor could do is if they did have a felony, so this bill could apply to a felony as well. They could decide that they don't like aggravators for one reason or another, or that they haven't had success with aggravators, and they could charge this as sort of a second count with a felony assault. So this is absolutely a misdemeanor, but as you know, you can charge a felony and a misdemeanor together if you wish. So this is what I would call a tool in the toolkit for prosecutors, and an important one. A couple other points, and then we can move to the PowerPoint. One of them is that there have been a couple comments from some very wise people, expressions of concern about how this bill would play out. And I'll tell you that right now in Title 18, you'll see the law on domestic violence. Again, my bill is not a domestic violence bill, although it's inclusive of domestic violence crimes, because they are typically assaults. They can be other things like criminal mischief, but this is an assault crime, and it would incorporate or subsume domestic violence assault as well, because that's a kind of assault. But there is currently, in Title 18, so the criminal code is Title 11, but 18 of our statutes is the domestic violence code, and it's sort of more than sort of linked to Title 11, mostly in an explanatory way, when you're looking for definitions and process, that sort of thing. There's a term in there about mandatory arrest for crimes involving domestic violence. And what happens is there's some instruction to the arresting officer that they must comply with a four-part test. And that is, when they're looking at two combating assailants and they don't know who's the culprit, if anyone. And by the way, if you're wondering, what if they're mutually responsible, you either probably don't have something to charge or you might have some sort of disorderly conduct. But at any rate, what a good police officer who's following the law would do is they would say to themselves and looking at their computers and their cars, et cetera, have there been prior complaints of domestic violence regarding A or regarding the victim, putative victim B? They then say, what is the relative severity of the injuries inflicted by each person? And of course, that's telling. That might tell you something. They might then ask or should ask, what is the likelihood of future injury from domestic violence from each person? And finally, whether one of the persons acted in defense of self or others. These are basic. I mean, I think elementary students could come up with a test, four tests like that. But there's been concern expressed to me that women in particular might be the victims, but may appear to be the culprits and may, out of an eagerness to get rid of the case and move on with their lives, take a no contest plea, which is the same as effectively in its effect as pleading guilty. What I would say is I thought about taking that four-prong test, which exists in law right now, and embedding it in my bill, but I think that's redundant. In other words, if the concern is expressed by the committee that that an overzealous officer could prosecute something like this at the initial charging stage, which is where they come in an overzealous way, that's a separate issue that concerns training. And the law that would steer them and guide them as to who to arrest or not arrest is already there in Title 18. Another issue that's arisen is situations where juveniles are charged. And what I would note there is that while our juvenile process is almost completely different or very different than our adult process, there's no such thing as a juvenile criminal code per se. So we don't have drunk driving by a juvenile or assault by a juvenile. We just have drunk driving and assault. We apply the same code. And my staff, Annalisa, and I discussed this at great length. Would we want 17-year-olds charged if they got in a melee and one was clearly the culprit and a 12-year-old or even a 15-year-old watched the fight? The answer is we couldn't find a reason necessarily to distinguish the 17-year-old from the 18-year-old. Because after all, as I've just said, we apply the same kind of criminal code anyway. We're not trying to beat up on 17-year-olds, for example. But, you know, we would hope that the juvenile probation officer and the police officer would use a rule of reason and say, well, geez, these two young men, high school seniors, got in a fight and there were 50 witnesses. And this is just sort of something for the school district to resolve through suspension or the like. So if that concern is raised, we didn't miss it or ignore it. We just thought that smart prosecutors and smart police officers would be reasonable about application of that. So those are the main features that I wanted to bring to your attention. Another thing that has arisen is the question of counts. So what if there were 10 children witnessing a fight? The answer is, and this goes back to my previous point, that theoretically you could have 10 counts. A smart prosecutor friend noted that when there's an indecent exposure, if 10 people witness the indecent exposure, there could be 10 counts. Because each victim has been harmed, and that's the theory. Now, the defense would want to, if they suffered a conviction, they would want to get into a discussion of running counts concurrently rather than consecutively, or agreeing to plead to only one count. And those would be discussions. Those are the things that go on today. So we're not changing that. And I suspect, without being an expert in it, that a judge would look at case law that said, you know, for example, if the underlying offense was an assault and 10 people saw the assault, at some point, it becomes absurd to say those 10 people, there should be a greater sentence for those 10 who saw the assault than for the victim who's lying on the ground. There's a point of absurdity there. So those are the things we're working on. We think that, you know, just today, in fact, in the mail on the floor, I received a letter, we all must have, from the Alaska Children's Trust, which notes that with thousands of cases substantiated every year, Alaska's per capita rate of child abuse and neglect is among the highest in the country, citing the Annie E. Casey Foundation Kids Count, and ranking Alaska 41st in the nation for child well-being. We think that this is an important public policy to say that kids are harmed, and we've all heard of ACEs scores and the like, by witnessing this kind of conduct. Last comment, I promise, and this is about merger. Some people may believe that that one act would result in two charges, and that's true. The one act would be the Super Bowl fight witnessed by 10 children. It's clearly one act. But recently, in a case called Linden, the Court of Appeals, which is the highest criminal appeals court, save the Supreme Court, which rarely takes up criminal cases on appeal but can, it's one of its justices, who, mind you, was a career public defender, so I'm not suggesting she would have any prejudice, but she spent a career looking through the lens of protecting her clients. And she concluded that this would not be double jeopardy. And she cited to a Supreme Court decision and a previous Alaska court decision. And fundamentally, what she concluded, and there was no dissent in the opinion, was that there are different victims. And that the municipality in 2000, when they came out with this policy, put on the record that there was a different trauma experienced by children than the person whose jaw was sore the next morning or the next afternoon. So in an opinion that is literally 14 months old, the Court of Appeals said, this is not violative of double jeopardy. And so any suggestion of the contrary, even if somebody felt that it was, this is the Bible, in effect. This is what the courts would look at, is the Linden decision. May I read briefly before I stop?
Please continue. And if you could send that document,
you bet,
document to the committee, that would be helpful for distribution.
You bet. So Wollenberg, citing to a memorandum that the Anchorage Assembly adopted in 2000, or adopted by reference when they created this so-called family violence, but we say assault in the presence of a child. She cites to the Assembly talking about specific types of harm, and that the harm from the exposure and the witnessing is a different kind of harm than the person whose eye is blackened. And here she quotes from the memorandum, the original code section criminalizing child abuse is repealed and four new sections, each aimed at a specific type of harm, are enacted. The changes are designed to provide a comprehensive enforcement tool that reflects increased awareness of the problems and seeks to more accurately address the distinctions between physical abuse, physical neglect, and other harms which may occur. So that's the Assembly saying, this is our public policy call. And that was important. And that's why we have to build a record in this building, too. And then finally, this is the judge speaking. This memorandum and the historical context for the enactment of the crime of family violence demonstrate that the Anchorage Assembly made a legislative determination that the conduct constituting family violence, assault in the presence of a child, constitutes a distinctly separate harm against a child, one which the current assault offense did not sufficiently vindicate, at least when the child was not the victim of the assault. So it's about recognizing the harm, emotional, psychic, caused to children by witnessing these offenses. Thank you very much. I'll answer any questions you have.
So we have members who have a few questions, but did you have any slides? Because I did tell you that I was going to try to go light on this first day and first, and I have to apologize that I think our previous presenters also did a great job on the first day out of the gate fielding questions. But did you want to take questions now or proceed with your slides?
I think we'll go to the slides and streamline things that way. So I'm going to give this to Ms. Roberts.
Can you hear me without the microphone?
Oh, no.
No, you please.
Are you okay?
We need the microphone for the record. Please state your name.
For the record, my name is Annalisa Roberts, Staffordshire Representative Josephson. As Representative Josephson has already covered, HB 11 provides and it establishes a Class A misdemeanor for the violation of having assault in the presence of a child following Municipal Code 810-050, family violence. As he also mentioned, we have an aggravator currently in the statute that is only applicable to a felony, and this is applicable. HB 11 will be applicable to either as an additional charge. According to the Research Center on Domestic Violence, researchers have estimated that between 3.3 million and 10 million children are exposed to adult domestic violence each year. And from 2016 to 2018, the number of intimate partner violence victimizations in the United States increased by 42%. This is a chart showing the number of cases filed in the state of Alaska through fiscal year 2020 of all domestic violence cases. And there was a peak in fiscal year 19, and it was still pretty high in 2020. Assault and domestic violence go hand in hand, with nearly 70% of assault cases having a domestic violence charge associated with them. These are domestic violence cases filed annually just for Anchorage alone, which has the domestic violence or the family violence municipal code. And these are the number of times that family violence under municipal code has been charged in domestic violence cases. A total of 1,224 family violence charges have been filed since 2018, with more than 20,000 domestic violence cases filed between 2018 and 2020. There's a high probability that children have witnessed more of these horrible crimes than what's already shown in Anchorage. This is the current maltreatment statute that we have on the record of what it means for maltreatment. And in 43 states, the exposure to domestic violence is included in the definition of maltreatment. Alaska is one of those states. Similar to Alaska, eight other states have aggravating circumstances when a child is witness to domestic violence or assault. In six states, there are separate charges that are brought, similar to what we're trying to do when a child witnesses domestic violence or assault in front of a child. These are some of the immediate reactions to intimate partner violence that a child can experience, starting from anxiety to nightmares, all the way down to intense worry about the safety of themselves or their parent, which no child should have to witness or experience. These are long-term effects of intimate partner violence on a child, from physical health problems to emotional difficulties in adulthood, depression, anxiety, PTSD. And these are the reactions broken out by age groups of what they experience from birth to 5 years old, age 6 to 11, and ages 12 to 18. This is the prosecutorial discretion that Representative Josephson already spoke about. Can be charged with a felony or a misdemeanor, can be charged with multiple counts, can be charged in lieu of the aggravator, and applies to any type of assault, not just domestic violence, and can be charged in any location if the crime of assault is committed in the presence of a child. So it's not just in the dwelling, it can be in a park, it can be anywhere else. And I will take any questions, or whoever, Representative Josephson can take any questions if there are any.
Thank you. I do have quite a few people in the queue. Let me see. Let me write some things down. But I have one question, and then I will take the I think just about every member, I have noted you as well, has questions. And it is my intent, before we begin questions, to bring this bill back before the committee. This is one that I want to take a deeper dive into and perhaps look at ACEs. And so the very first question that I have for you is, this is regarding assault in the presence of a child. Has there been any data linking the likelihood of that in the presence of becoming assaulting a child?
This is Annalisa Roberts for the record. Not that I've been able to find, but we can take a deeper look into that.
Thank you. And so we have first in the queue, Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, question regarding something that you did not present on, and if the answer is not readily available, then I can get it later. I want to understand what the penalty for a first-time offender of a Class A is, Class A misdemeanor, and what the multiples of a Class A might be. And you might know that off the top of your head and could answer it, or we can get that answer at a later date.
I'm going to take my knowledge is about 20 years old, but here's what I would what I believe. The misdemeanor, that's what this is, has a maximum penalty of 1 year. That is guaranteed. Typically, a first offense for an assault, in my experience, which is some time ago, would vary depending on the criminal history of the defendant. For example, how many other like cases have they been convicted of? Are they currently on probation? Because they could have time revoked, and that would factor into, from a previous case, they could have suspended time imposed, and that might factor into a judge's decision. The severity of the crime, but in misdemeanors, it's more of a generalized argument than a very precise sentencing code. Probably there's some variation in misdemeanors as a consequence. When I left the criminal law, if it was a second assault, I think there was a mandatory minimum of 30 days. So if somebody was charged with assaulting by blackening the eye of their spouse in front of their children, they're likely to spend at least that night in custody. If they have been a Rotary member and, you know, an upstanding citizen and all those sorts of things, they may just get a suspended sentence. Now, what their defense lawyer would want to do is try to, if the evidence was solid, because of the competitive time in the life of a prosecutor in the court system, they may declare victory with one count. And that may bother some of you, but that's the system. So they may say, we'll dismiss one count, you plead to one count. So it's going to vary between 0 days and 365 days.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. And on a slightly different angle here, what would be the effect of the legislation if we were to exclude minors from the applicability of enforcement of the legislation?
You know, through the chair, in some respects it wouldn't be that substantial. Right. So what we know for sure is that Anchorage, so 300,000 people produce about 270 charges of this a year. So one might think that 700,000 Alaskans might produce, you know, 700 charges. Now, how many of those would be situations where it was a minor under 18? We could guess, you know, maybe 30, 20. I don't know. That would be one way to eliminate the school ground fight circumstance. But note that you could have two fathers watching a football game who really get into it in the stands, and someone gets, you know, someone gets hurt. They fall off the bleachers and they break a leg. So you don't want to swing, in my view, completely swing the pendulum the other direction. Those are my thoughts.
Thank you.
Okay. I do have another question, and then I will go to Representative or Vice Chair Allard. And the question is, how do you define presence? If there's a wall dividing the child, or maybe it's on a Zoom call, you know, FaceTime, and an assault happens, is that exempted or is that covered under this?
The answer is that present, and Madam Chair, Andy Josephson again, know that we consulted with a top former municipal prosecutor on this to get his perspective. He's now retired recently. We consulted with the Department of Law, informally, but with the Department of Law, and we consulted with our own attorneys up the hill in the Terry Miller building. And we thought that the bill should say that present means physically present or within hearing. And, you know, again, we think that a prosecutor would not be overly zealous, right? So if you have a three-story home and a child slept through an assault, well, that may be physically present in that they're in the dwelling, but it doesn't make much of a case, right? And I don't know if you'd end up with jury nullification where the prosecutor would say they were in the house, and the jury said, yeah, but they weren't impacted by this directly. So, but I'll tell you, it's hard to write a perfect criminal code. We think that this is fairer to the defendant in that we're trying to circumscribe to some degree the proximity question.
Well, that was one of the concerns of, do you feel that you took the broad approach to this rather than being very specific, as you mentioned, other codes have done. And can you speak one more time of why you think this more generalized approach is going to fit our statute better?
Well, let me look first of all. Where's the municipal code? Do you have that? You know, what the municipality has is the word presence. And we're trying to find that. So the municipality says the crime is committed when the person, and I quote, commits the crime of assault as defined in Section 810.010. So you've got to have a predecessor or, you know, predicate assault with knowledge or reckless disregard of the presence of a child. So we think that we've actually done better in framing what we mean by presence. And that's important because of due process considerations and ambiguity. So where you run into problems with a crime is if the defendant can't know what it is that they shouldn't be doing, right? Now, in this appeal from 2021, that wasn't the subject. They didn't raise the issue of presence and what that means. Perhaps it was obvious in the Linden case that Mr. Linden was absolutely present when it happened. I suspect that was the case. So they argued merger. But this language has existed for 23 years, and it's still there. And that tells me that the language works. But we're trying to be somewhat helpful to the court and the attorneys by saying, this is what we mean. And therefore, we create a definition for what we mean by present.
Thank you. Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. I have a few. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Josephson, so some of my questions are, and I kind of want to get
a feeling of location. So I believe you said they may not take place necessarily at the victim or the perpetrator's home. Right. Is that an accurate statement?
Through the chair, correct.
Thank you. So my question would be, what about in public situations? I can give you quite a few examples. Reading pornography, sexual content at school, sexual reference within school, public libraries, and public testimony with government-led officials with children present. So would these be something that would fall under this? Because it's very wide. It says a child's involvement can range from overhearing, witnessing confrontations, to being physically injured during the course of an altercation. But pornography and some of these other things that I've listed are already against the law with the child. So could you expand on that?
Through the chair, you're describing pornography, and I'm describing witnessing an assault.
Okay.
And pornography is many things, but it's when one views it, if one does, it's typically not an assault.
Okay. So
follow-up, Representative?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. So with the follow-up, you said that presence of a child or children can have a long-lasting negative impact. So you're saying that under this bill, it would only be a physical, it wouldn't be emotional, it wouldn't be verbal. So if two parents are, thank you. If two parents are arguing, that's just what they're doing, they're arguing. They wouldn't be into, it can be considered an altercation. Is that something that this would be included in the bill?
Through the chair, so I don't have the AS 1141 right in front of me, but there is a version of it. So there are many different kinds of misdemeanor assault. There is a version that speaks to imminent physical threat of injury. So a person who puts their fist near someone's nose and says, "I'm going to pop you," has probably assaulted that person, even if they don't swing at the person. So, but a fight, a verbal fight about money, for example, unless there was a threat and a charge. Remember, the police would first have to have a predicate charge. So if for some reason a spouse could say, you know, my spouse is furious at me because I went to Las Vegas and spent $500 and somehow convinced them that what was going to follow was a physical assault, then I guess they could charge an assault. But it sounds like a pretty weak case. So it's possible to be assaulted without being touched. Okay. That's the key. But what you're describing doesn't sound like an assault.
Okay. Can I do a quick follow-up, Madam Chair, and then I'll be done because I know we got a long ways to go on this one. Okay, so when you have individuals that are speaking in a public testimony, say the Assembly Chamber, we've used the MOA as an example, and words are being spoken and there is another person, community member, that is in the room, and there's what they could perceive an altercation has arisen, and now their children are present and the police have been called in. Would this fall underneath that?
Through the chair, as I said, Representative Allard, it could if there was an assault charged in the Assembly Chamber incident you described.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my questions are follow-ups to Representative Carpenter's. They're both extensions of Representative Carpenter's. The first would be, I understand that it's we're adding an additional misdemeanor charge that would increase the fourth degree assault, which is also a misdemeanor. Would it also increase the sentences for the, and I want to preface all this by, I am not a lawyer and I am reading statutes for the first time. And so these are very basic questions. I want to know, what is a typical sentence for a first degree assault, a second degree assault, a third degree assault, and a fourth degree assault? And how much would this extend that sentence? That basically, and then as part of that question, if our goal, and maybe I'm wrong, if the goal is to extend the sentence, why don't we change the sentencing like we did for an assault, like the legislature's done for an assault on a police officer, for example? Like maybe, I guess I just need to understand why a different crime or a new crime, why not change the sentencing? That's my first question.
Okay.
So we are going to have an overview to give you further detail as to the different to the different levels. So Representative Josephson doesn't have to address that. But if you could speak specifically to the purpose of adding this particular assault in the presence of a child to Chapter 11, to 1141, if you could speak to that, then.
And then if I might, I'd like to take a quick, because that's probably all I can provide, stab at the question. There were many, it was a compound question, which means there were many there. But the purpose of this law is this. If two people fight one another, two adults fight one another, and they're alone in a room or dwelling or on the street, or they're with other adults, the trauma is not what it would be if you had those same sets of facts and added children to the mix. That's how simple it is. This is about recognizing the separate experience of children who witness assaults. So this is really about the protection of children. That's what this bill's about. But let me say real quickly to Representative Gray, good questions. I wouldn't say that we're increasing the assault charge. You start, prosecutors and defense are always aware of the background sentence code, but you start with wondering how many counts will there be a conviction for. We would not be adding to the underlying assault directly. That's in its own silo. We would have another count because you harmed the kids when you did it. Count one caused harm that we call count two because you did it in front of children. Then the battle would be at sentencing, which can happen fast in misdemeanors. It could happen right after the plea or the conviction. And the battle would be over whether those charges run at the same time, which is called concurrently, or whether they're stacked, that's called consecutively. Now, one thing I will tell you, if you're the defendant and you suffer two convictions, even if you run them concurrently, that means you're not going to jail any longer than you would have with count one. But on paper, you're going to have these two convictions. That's probably not a good thing either. And then you asked about assaults 1, 2, 3, and 4. It's very complicated, but assault 4 is a misdemeanor, therefore no more than a year. Assault 3 is a C felony, therefore no more than 5 years. Assault 2 is a B felony, therefore not more, I think, than 10. And assault 1, that gets mighty complicated. I mean, there's probably circumstances that exceed 50 years, but I could be wrong about that. So effectively, and note that assault 3, you can imagine that assault 4, that the level of injury is just growing with each count as you rise up to assault 1.
Okay. Madam Chair, if I can ask the second question, which is also going directly off of Representative Carpenter's question. There was a slight concern that I had regarding minors, the school example, for example, and I think removing minors might be a solution. However, I'd still have concern about two 18-year-olds in high school who got into a fight in front of their classmates. I think, and I say this with all due respect, and really to protect police officers. You said, well, we would hope that a reasonable police officer would not add this charge. But I think, I'm not really sure that that's the correct person. I think we could be, I'm just curious if there's a way to make it more specific. If we're talking about domestic violence, can we make this about domestic violence so that you don't have an 18-year-old who gets an added charge because he assaulted a classmate in front of other classmates? Like, I just worry that there could perhaps be situations, maybe rare, where an 18-year-old could get additional charges from this law, even though that's not the intent of the law.
Well, through the chair, remember that 18-year-olds are treated as adults, right? So I'm not changing that at all. That's number one. And number two, so that's a whole nother bucket of issues that I'm not delving into, but you're welcome to. Number two, remember that the code right now says that as a matter of policy in 1255-155, we're concerned with children up to age 16 being exposed to crime. And that's the aggravator provision. And then my other comment is you may mention domestic violence. You know, I can only tell you that I, as the sponsor, am very concerned about domestic violence, but this bill is broader in that it doesn't have to have meet the definition in Title 18 of what constitutes domestic violence, right? So those are my responses. And then I guess finally, just recall that the criminal code we apply to children is the same. There's no murder in the first degree by a child. There's just murder in the first degree. It's how we process those cases that's different in juvenile matters.
Thank you, Representative Josephson. I have questions from Representative Johnson, and then we will go to Representative Groh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, thank you, Representative Josephson. You talked about how this was, you know, the trauma caused. But none of this is kicked in unless there's a crime committed. That doesn't mean there's still not trauma. So if we're really wanting to protect the child, why wouldn't you offer a charge for people just doing it in front of, like, I'll give you an example, a group of kids playing basketball in the yard and their parents are yelling and the mother's beating up the father or vice versa. The trauma still exists, yet maybe no charges are filed. So that does nothing to address the trauma in the child. Would it be something to think about that they're not necessarily having to be a crime before a crime of traumatizing a kid? So I'm just wondering, I see a disconnect because you're not fixing the trauma if there are no charges. Trauma still exists. So I got a little disconnect there about why couldn't it be a crime if some charges aren't filed, but it's in the presence of the child.
Through the chair, I mean, you're then getting into, we had a slide about maltreatment. And so this is really the criminal side of what's already in Title 47, I think, our maltreatment code or definition. So theoretically, what you're describing could result in a call to the Office of Children's Services, that sort of thing. There are people who, no one reports the offense because they're afraid of mom and dad, or they don't want mom and dad to break up, or no other child who witnessed it reports it to their mom and dad. And so we know that there are lots of instances in the world where things just aren't charged. But, this is something the municipality has done. I think the assembly was right in 2000 when they said this is a separate offense. It has survived this merger claim that there's double jeopardy. The court was very clear that there's not double jeopardy. As with all crime, we're hoping that this works as what I call a PSA or public service announcement, that of course we're not terribly good at that, but that people will read about this in the daily news and they'll say, "Ooh, I'm going to have to really control myself in those circumstances." And of course the defendant has the protection that there's got to be the underlying charge, regardless if children are present or not. But you're right. You're getting into the issue, Representative Johnson, of behavioral health and family health and all of those other lying social issues that we also need to deal with.
Follow up? Representative Groh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As a former prosecutor like you, Representative Josephson, I very much appreciate this bill, the intent behind it, and addressing Alaska's very high rates of crime, including crimes for instance, children, particularly violent crimes. But I wanted to, given my background as a prosecutor, let me ask you sort of a more practical, on-the-ground question. Has your research or discussions about this proposed statute led you to some sort of belief that perhaps the main effect of it is that this would be essentially trade bait negotiations, that essentially there's usually going to be a charge of assault already? There has to be, to get a conviction in this case, you have to prove that there was an assault, right, as you have noted. So normally in this kind of case, there was already going to be an assault charge. And then there would be an additional charge under this new statute of assault in the presence of a child. As I said, with this essentially, in terms of how it actually played out in the court system and the negotiations between prosecutors and defense attorneys, essentially be trade bait for a charge to be dropped in return for a plea of guilty or no contest.
Through the chair, Representative Groh, that could be the effect. But I want to be clear that this is about in my mind's eye, this is about a protecting children from exposure to the event, right? And I know, as we all know, that you know, we could reduce the DWI or DUI BAC to 0.06 within a week. There's still going to be drunk drivers. Even if everyone in the state read that, there's going to be drunk drivers. So we know this isn't going to stop it, but we think it's an important public policy position. What I think Representative Groh is talking about is that typically, if I represented a gentleman who was charged with assaulting his wife in front of his kids, and he came to my office and had these two counts, the prosecutor, to save time, unless they had lots of time or were really eager because they really disliked my client, they're likely to offer some sort of deal. Because if they said, the offer we extend to you is that your client be convicted of both counts, then we're going to go to trial, probably. Now, what goes into that equation is, I'm going to demand a trial fee, which I wouldn't otherwise demand. And if the case is really good, they're going to win two counts rather than pleading for one, et cetera, et cetera. So all those factors go into it. And then along with how many convictions, you can negotiate the length of the sentence. And what the judge will do is, if it's within the realm of reasonableness, it's their job to accept what's called a Rule 11 agreement. So, you know, if I was foolish enough to say, yeah, my client's willing to go to jail for a full year and has never been charged before, well, first of all, that shame on me. That would be sort of legal malpractice. But the judge should also not accept that. He should look at me and say, you need a different attorney than this legislator. But that's, I don't mean to have fun with this, but that's sort of where Representative Groh is going with this discussion.
Thank you, Representative Carpenter.
thank you for another bite at the apple today, Madam Chair. I am on board with the concept. I think that the need to send a message that stepping outside to take care of business is appropriate, whether it's right. You're thinking about the kids, right? Like Representative Groh, I'm a little concerned that this becomes one of the lesser things that kind of falls away during the prosecution of this. So could the committee consider a way to draft this whereby it stands alone? It is so doggone important that we send a message that you do not do this within the hearing or sight or presence of kids. This behavior is unacceptable. And you might get charged with assault and you can plea down something there, but this one stands alone. It is going to be not pled away because we value our kids that much. We value what this message sends to the kids. If we are having a fight, we're sending a message that it's okay.
Through the chair, I can tell that I must be presenting well enough because I've got someone who agrees with me on the underlying point. I wish that the Department of Law were here. They may be on the phone. Here's what jumps to mind for me. First of all, it already is a standalone. Well, you're right. The thing is, it has to be linked to assault because it's called assault in the presence of a child, right? So it just doesn't exist without a predicate assault. That's number one. So you're right. It doesn't stand. For example, if I possess a drug while I'm burglarizing a bank, those really stand alone. They're not reliant on one another, probably. These are linked. You're right. You're talking about the disposition of the case. I'd have to look at Rule 11. I don't know that there's any, and that's a court criminal rule. I don't know that there's any rule that says no prosecutor can dismiss this. There is a policy. So Attorney General Craig Taylor could say, we are never going to dismiss one of these. Now, then you'd get into the fiscal note issue and all the rest. And it would push more trials. So you're going to get court system trial time to come out of that. And I don't know if the executive branch would say, look, you're tying our hands. But I like where you're going. I just don't know whether we can do that exactly.
Representative Joseph Zunn, can you speak to why this is a Class A misdemeanor? Perhaps that might be a little bit of the direction that Representative Carpenter was seeking. Is there a reason that this is identified as a Class A misdemeanor, or should it be considered a tougher penalty?
Through the chair, I'm just going based on memory. There are child protection types of criminal loads, codes, like endangering the welfare of a child. That can go up, I think, to a C felony. In fact, I know it can because I was very concerned that under SB 91, there'd be essentially no jail time for committing that offense. I think the municipality of Anchorage has it right that it feels like a misdemeanor to me. I'm not minimizing. Obviously, I'm all concerned about the children, what they're witnessing. It would be a little bit odd to have the underlying charge be in a misdemeanor and the linked or ancillary charge be more severe than the underlying charge. I think that would be very, very unusual.
All right, Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. And to that very point, I would take it and be the exact opposite. Two guys fighting and there's no kids around. That's happened for eons.
Yes.
Two guys fighting and they don't have the self-discipline to take it away from the kids. That is only something that is more recently occurring. And it is a detrimental thing to our society. So I would wish we would take an approach that says two guys fighting, well, we might be able to overlook that, but two guys fighting in the presence of kids is not acceptable ever, period. End of sentence. And if you're going to fight together, you're going to get a Class A. If you're going to fight with a kid, you're going to get a felony, right? That's the level of thinking, the value I place on the child.
Through the chair, I mean, that's a policy call. I mean, one way to handle that would be to say there were, you know, Bill was babysitting four children, got in a fight with Tom, blackened Tom's eye, and you know, the state could run five counts. Bill, count one, Bill assaulted Tom. Count two, three, four, and five, four children witnessed the assault. And you could do that. Now, if you refuse to settle, you're going to force a trial. And that's okay. I mean, Bill could go to jail for quite a while, all on misdemeanors, theoretically. It would come down to the question of sentencing and whether they were concurrent or consecutive.
Representative Josephson, went on the follow-up hearing, I think it would be helpful if you were to provide some context for the committee of, you know, I think we need to weigh assaulting a child. Right, child abuse, and this is in the presence of, and what the punishment is for that, and just kind of help us have some perspective. Before I get too far, are there any further questions by the committee today? So I really appreciate just the depth and the passion that you have on this piece of legislation, and I said, hey, this is going to be super light first, and really, everyone just jumped right in, and I really appreciate that. And this is what we do in judiciary. We have to look at the definition of every word, the intent of the legislation, and the impacts that it's going to have on sentencing, the impacts that it's going to have on families, the broader picture. And so we will be taking a look at this. So if the committee has any further questions, please email them, and I encourage you to have further conversations to get insight. But I do want to take a look at this broader perspective and of the impacts of crime on our children and in the presence of children. And we will be looking at sentencing and how that works. So thank you again. And that concludes our business for today. Our next committee hearing will be next Monday, January 30th, and the committee will be given a presentation by the Alaska Court System. Seeing there is no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect that it is 2:46 p.m.